The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome. Last week, Diana asked me if I would give a talk this evening, since both she and Gil are teaching a week-long retreat at IRC. And it's been several years since I've given a talk, so I'm a little rusty, so hopefully you'll bear with me. I thought tonight I would talk a little bit about what brought me to practice, what brought me to IMC, and also what keeps me practicing, what supports the continual practice. So I'll start with a little bit of history. I came to IMC in January of 1998, when we were meeting in Palo Alto. And the reason I came was because there was an inescapable unsatisfactoriness in my life. I had good friends, I had a good job, good health, and yet there was something that just seemed off. You know, I couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't quite get any of the usual remedies for dissatisfaction or unhappiness that are offered by our culture to really work as well as I'd like it to. And so a friend of mine had told me about Spirit Rock, a meditation center up in Marin County. And I looked at their website, and one of their links was to this place in Palo Alto, Insight Meditation Center, which was only about 10 minutes from where I lived. So I went there, and on the very first night, Gil was just finishing the last of a four-week series on the Four Noble Truths. And I'll summarize those rather briefly. He was talking about how there's this thing called dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering or stress or dissatisfaction. One teacher translates it as bummerness, the bummerness of life. So it can come in all sorts of forms and intensities, but basically this dissatisfaction, which I was feeling. And the teaching around that, calling it a noble truth, was that rather than trying to push it aside or covet it over or replace it with something else, the instruction was to really pay attention to it, that there was some value, something important about investigating this unsatisfactoriness, this dukkha, as he called it. So it was both, the first noble truth was both a description, but also an encouragement for action, to really recognize it when it was operating. It required some action on my part, or on the part of a meditator. The second noble truth was that there's a cause for this. And the cause is clinging, trying to hold on. If it's a pleasant experience, trying to hold on to the pleasantness, hold on to something Or if it's an unpleasant experience, trying to hold on to the absence of this experience. And, of course, the problem with that is that the things that one often tries to cling to are unclingable, if that's a word. That there are things that you just can't cling to because they're going to change. They come about by conditions and they disappear when conditions change. And so it's not that we can make our experience just the way we want it, but it's how we're relating to this this experience, this taking this attitude that we're going to try to hold on for dear life to something that can't be held on to. And the action associated with that is to release the clinging, somehow to release. The third noble truth has to do with experiencing the ending of dukkha, the ending of suffering. And that's something to be realized. And this might not even be like a once and you're done experience. It might be that the clinging ends and the suffering ends for a second, for a minute, for an hour, however long. Undoubtedly, you'll start clinging again, but you know, just having that, recognizing that experience of at least temporarily being free of the dukkha is something to be experienced. And then finally, the fourth noble truth was that there's a path to be developed so that this recognition, this release, and this experience of freedom can come more often. And when I heard that talk, I knew this is the place for me to be. You know, Gil was talking about exactly what I was experiencing and offering a certain hope that through practice, through actions of my own, I could lead a life with less dissatisfaction, or maybe more satisfaction, more happiness. And that was just transformational for me to hear that talk. And so I found him inspiring. Now, at that point, I didn't know, I had heard about this mindfulness meditation, but I had really never learned how to do it or what it was. That first night, I had over the previous 6 or 7 years, I had learned transcendental meditation. So I did that the first night. And then fortunately, the very next Monday, there was an introductory course to mindfulness meditation, a 45-minute course. And it was taught by this woman, Margaret. And she explained to us about paying attention to the very simple experiences that of life, you know, of the breath, of bodily sensations, of emotions, of thoughts. And the thing that struck me was just her presence. She was kind. She was thoughtful. There's a serenity about her. And I remember after the end of the first class that I took with her, thinking that if she's the product of this practice, this is what I want to be doing. I want the qualities that she's expressing. And even though I had taken the course, the next month I took it again just to have more of that same experience of being in her presence. So the inspiration from Gil and the clarity and cognitive experience of hearing his Dharma talk, and the following week having this experience of the presence that Margaret displayed really let me know that I was where I wanted to be, or at least starting a path, starting a practice. And in the coming months, about half the time, Gil would have a guest speaker. Often people from Spirit Rock or from San Francisco Zen Center, some various monastics, and some people that came from I don't know where. But they were all inspiring. And one of the things that I also liked about IMC in those first weeks and months that I was there was that people are just left you alone. It was fine to just come in, sit, listen to the talk, and then just walk out into the night, you know, luxuriating in what I had just heard, you know, just reflecting on it, thinking about it, feeling what it felt like to have heard these teachings that I had never heard before. And I didn't have to stop and chit-chat. I didn't have to put on a social persona or explain why I was there. And I didn't have to explain myself. I could just come and go, and people left me alone. And I really valued that. For a number of months, I don't know exactly how long, and I really saw it as a solitary practice. Like, this is something that I'm doing for me. It's my happiness, my tranquility, my peace of mind. And in some ways, that's true. I mean, nobody can meditate for you. Nobody can listen to talks for you. Nobody can have the insights that come from this practice. You can't job it out. It requires your own inspiration, motivation, determination. There's some part of it that really takes your commitment and your time and your energy to do the practice. Over time, I don't know, maybe within 4 to 8 months, roughly. Although it's a little hard for me to remember back then. I noticed that I wanted to talk to people about the practice. I wanted to talk to someone, and I found that my non-practicing friends, although they would be patient with me, they'd listen, they just couldn't figure out what I was talking about or why, you know. Why would you pay attention to dissatisfaction? Why would you pay attention to suffering? It just didn't make sense to them. And I was new enough that I couldn't really put this in words that maybe made sense. For example, like when I talked about doing metta, loving kindness practice, where you wish well for someone, even though they're not wishing well back for you. You know, this sort of unilateral well-wishing for other people. you know, wasn't the usual transactional well-wishing that people were used to. You know, they said, well, if the person doesn't wish you well back, I mean, how long is that going to last? You're going to give up pretty quickly. So that was just one example of the kind of thing that I was learning about that just didn't connect. And so about the time that I was wanting to talk to other people, a couple of people that were also Monday night regulars started coming up to me and saying, well, how'd you like to have coffee? You know, like, how about if we meet for a meal before the Monday night sit? And let's talk about this. And so I formed a few informal friendships that way and, you know, started to have a few discussions. And I also thought, well, if I want to talk about this, what I really need to do is talk with a master, the maestro, like Gil. And so I went to him and, you know, I think I asked him if he would meet with me once a week to have a discussion. And, you know, he was like, well, he wouldn't do that, but I could schedule interviews with him. And so for a time, I met with him about once a month. And those were useful for me. Although I did find that maybe not consciously or not so consciously, I wanted to look good in his eyes. I wanted to be a good Buddhist. And at some point, he related to me this story that when he was a young Zen practitioner at San Francisco Zen Center, that one of his teachers told him that much of what he was going to learn about Buddhism, he was going to learn from his peers. And when he told me that, I sort of thought that it was a polite brush off. I didn't, you know. That he's like, yeah, talk to some of these other people. But I took him at his word, and I found that that actually was true, that there was a way that having these discussions about the things that I didn't understand, I'm not sure that I believed or had experienced with other people, really helped the practice, that it wasn't just about learning facts or learning from somebody that had already experienced things, but it was the talking to other people about it, questioning, that really helped clarify things for me. And so the next year, I did a 10-day retreat with Gil and two of his friends, John and Mary. And on that retreat, I learned several things. Those teachers started to say more than once that we don't do this practice for ourselves alone. Now, I kind of thought that I was doing this for myself alone. You know, I didn't, it was fine with me if other people benefited from it, but I didn't, that wasn't my motivation to support other people or to benefit them in some way. But on that retreat, I noticed what support I was getting from the other yogis. We weren't talking to each other, but just the fact that other people were showing up and sitting, you know, session after session was inspiring and helped me keep sitting, even though it was periods of pain, you know, to just sit for 45 minutes at a time. One person in particular who was inspiring to me was there was a woman that was sitting the retreat who was, I think, 8 months pregnant. Now, from what I understand, at that point in pregnancy, you're probably uncomfortable all the time. The body just... And yet, she was just sitting there, so still, with a serene look on her face. And I just thought, wow, that was inspiring to me. You know, and that she was doing it not only for herself, but I imagined doing it also for this soon-to-be-born child. And so there was a way in which my heart opened by being around the other practitioners. And after that retreat, I found myself making friends with some of the other yogis on that retreat. Andrea Fella was on that retreat, Jen Lemus, and some other people who are now teachers. And so I did start to get that sense of, oh yeah, maybe there is something that is going on beyond this particular body, this particular heart and mind. And then less than a year later, that the following spring, I did a 14-day retreat with Gil. And because so many people had canceled, it turned out it was just Gil and 12 yogis at this little zendo, Jikoji, up on Skyline. And there was such an intimacy to it. It rained the first 12 of the 14 days. It was cold. We just had a couple little wood stoves to keep us warm, in which, you know, one person, this guy Peter, would just like, between every sitting, he'd put more wood in the fire. He kept us warm. He took care of us. The water system broke, so we had no running water. We had to bathe in the pond and carry water from the creek for other dishwashing, and the local fire department brought in drinking water for us each day. But there was something about that particular retreat that made me feel so close to these other people. I mean, you know, these other 11 people, well, 12 including Gil. Yeah, that it's a retreat I'll never forget. I mean, it was the antithesis of some of these Golden Palace type retreat centers where it's warm and it's comfortable and the lights go on and off on their own. This was really just pretty primitive, but because there were so few people, Gil would give us interviews every single day. And at the end of that retreat, I was invited by a couple that was on it to join what they call the Kalyanamitta group. Sometimes it's translated as spiritual friends or beautiful friends. People that wanted to talk about the Dharma and about their experiences and create a sense of community. And so I didn't know what this was, but since they invited me, I thought, well, I'll at least go a couple of times and see what's up with it. And it would always start, we'd always sit together for 45 minutes. We'd have a meal together, so there was that sense of community from sharing a meal. And then we did this thing called a listening circle, where we'd set a timer, and each person had something like about maybe 4 to 6 minutes to say whatever it was they wanted to say, and everyone else just listened. There was no questions or comments or advice or clarifications. One person just said whatever it was that wanted to be said, including nothing at all, and everyone else just was as present as they could be, just listened. And at first, you know, I would sort of plan, well, what am I going to say, and what's, you know, what I need to get this, I need to rehearse what I'm going to say. But over time, I came to trust that what wanted to be heard from me would emerge. I didn't need to plan it. I didn't need to, you know, somehow have some agenda. That as we trusted each other and the listening deepened, that I learned to trust myself. I learned to trust that what wanted to be seen would emerge. I also learned that 4 or 5 minutes can go by pretty fast, and so that it was important to really, in some ways, get to the point, you know, to not waste time on things that weren't so important, but really kind of, you know, what's really going on? You know, some deep honesty. And so that was very helpful for me, you know, particularly talking about what was working for me in practice and also what wasn't. What, you know, where was I stuck? And that group lasted about 2 years, roughly. And then the couple moved away. And then I was invited into another group. And that group I still meet with. We've been meeting now for about 20 years. And then over time, there were some neighborhood groups that I was in. There's one that I'm in right now in Mountain View. Each group has a somewhat different structure, different way of doing things. But the commonality is that willingness to listen to each other and trust that we can talk about what's going on in practice for us. One of the things I like to say is, it's a great place to talk about how you fail as a Buddhist. You know, there's a lot of times when you like to think of yourself as this well-practiced Buddhist person, and there's value in that, but there's also value in seeing, you know, talking about what, you know, kind of what things aren't working, what have you done that you regretted? And that's, for me, that's really been a way to grow in a way that I don't think I could do just on my own if I was just sitting at home meditating and listening to talks and reading books. For a while, I was in a group that was supporting somebody that was dying, somebody that had cancer, and we thought it was only going to last a few weeks. And he ended up lasting a couple years. I started another group thinking about peers, since I'm a senior age male, I started a group of other senior age males. And so we could talk about, you know, what it's like to have a body that's breaking down, you know, that's starting to fail, and how, what do we still aspire to? What keeps us practicing? How to become not resigned to, but in accord with our mortality. So those are some of the things that came out of that group. I was also in a social group called the Dharma Friends, where we would go and see movies or go for hikes. There's a book group that's started back in the 90s that's still meeting here once a month. So I'm telling you all of this because my belief is that there's a real value in connecting with others in this practice. There's a saying that I've heard over a number of times about how one of the Buddha's disciples had one time told somebody that noble friends and noble conversations are half of the holy life. And the Buddha corrected him and he said, no, it's not half of the holy life. It's all of the holy life. So the way we respond to, support, are in community with others is integral to this process of becoming free. I don't really know if it's possible to become free on your own. So I'd like to encourage people to start. So first of all, I want to say I know the value of solitude, and that was really important to me, being able to practice without being involved in social interaction that was unwelcome. And I'd also like to encourage people that feel like they're at a point where they want to be able to connect with other people to look for ways to connect. I know it's been difficult over the last couple years with the pandemic. You know, at one point we used to have like 60 or 80 people in this room on a Monday night. You know, now we've got a handful. But there are virtual ways of meeting. Sunday mornings, there's a Zoom after the Sunday talk. People are starting to meet out in the parking lot outside of IMC on Sunday mornings. There's a lot of small group discussion that goes on through the happy hour groups Monday through Friday. There's the way of meeting people through either day-long classes, or there are some even like 8 to 12-month classes that are being offered now by IMC and other places. Just this afternoon, I was in the Dharma Mentor Training Program where we meet once a month and split off into small groups to talk. I think Gil and Diana are offering some courses on ethics as enlightenment, and two others that they rotate through. So I can't give you an exhaustive list of how you might make the kind of connections to support practice through dialogue. But if you, I'm sure if you start looking around, you'll find ways. So so I appreciate your tuning in tonight to this talk, and I'll be available for questions or comments for the next couple minutes, either from those of you who are here at IMC in person, or Nancy will monitor the chat on YouTube if you want to offer a question that way. So, thank you.
Jim, this is Nancy. Can you say more about the groups that you are part of? Are those ones the neighborhood groups that you can sign up through the website, or did you create a group on your own?
Yeah, that's a good question. This was, I think the first group was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And about every 3 years, IMC would put out a call for if people were interested in joining a group, that they could send in their contact information and their zip code, and they would be matched with other people. And usually those groups started out with a kind of a fixed agenda, you know, readings and things like that, and then might over time deepen. I don't know whether they're doing that right now, but if you're interested, I'm sure that if you send an email to the main IMC email site, that they could let you know what's available. Some of the groups, the first group that I was in lasted for maybe 4 years and then disbanded. Another one that was an existing group that had, was already ongoing, invited me to join them. And that one I imagine going for some time. So I think if you contact IMC, they could let you know what groups are available.
I know that there are links on the IMC website for individual practice discussion with a teacher and then group practice discussions. And I believe that you need to email to get hooked up with a neighborhood sangha that meets regularly.
Oh,
I think that's right. And the Sati Center also is teaching a number of classes that Gil and a number of other teachers have small groups.
Ah, great. Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Yeah. One other program that IMC has is this Eightfold Path program. It's, I think the Eightfold Path is a 9-month series, and that has small group interactions every month for each of the elements. And if you want, you can sign up to get a mentor, so you can have somebody to talk to once a month that can offer encouragement and sound you out that way. So that the current cycle, I think, is just coming to an end right now, but it usually starts again in the fall, maybe September.
Jim, one other thing is that there is a new beginner meditation program that's starting in August.
Okay.
That will be meeting in person at IMC.
Okay.
It's supposed to be on the calendar already.
Okay. Okay, so that what you said that was in August? Yeah, so there's also an introductory meditation course, in-person course, that's starting in August. So that's another way to make connection. Do you see anything on the... Oh, did...
Thank you very much. I appreciate what you had to share. Definitely identify with that dissatisfaction and bummerness. So I guess I'm in the right place too. it's about finding your own path, and I'm trying to figure out how to do that. So all of these suggestions are of lots of different things, different ways to start down a path is a little overwhelming, but also very helpful. So thank you on that. And then I hear a lot from people that practice about, you know, letting go. And I imagine that's letting go of the suffering, or I don't know what that means when people say, oh, you know, it's all, the first step is letting go. Okay, I get the concept of clinging, but if I'm already just kind of softening, then what does it mean to let go?
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, you know, I'd start with just saying that. What does it mean to let go? I'm trying to remember. There was one of the monastics said that something like 80% of the time they're sitting in meditation, knowing they need to let go and can't. So I don't think that it's strictly something that the ego or the intellect can do. I think it's, to a certain extent, it's seeing the suffering and seeing what is it that we're just not... you know, if you can see the connection between what you're clinging to and the suffering, then the clinging may dissolve on its own. But I believe you can't make it happen, and you can't definitely make it happen on your time schedule. You know, it's kind of like sitting with it until.
So until don't just knock three times and turn around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Well, it's 9:01. So, thank you all for your attention, and if this has been helpful, then. Stay with it, and if it's not helpful, just let it go. Thank you.